Welcome to Journeys Fire, a weekly program for the visionary and the passionate soul on a mission. I'm Richard Brendan, professional speaker, life purpose coach, counselor, and former hospice chaplain. My purpose in life is to inspire the fire that burns within you and reawaken your heart for love, life, and work. Each week, I'll be bringing you engaging conversations with today's visionary leaders and social change artists. I believe that true fulfillment begins when we say yes to our dreams and take bold and inspired action to design the lives we are created for. Are you ready to live your best life? Well, Journey's Fire begins now. Through our zeal for creature comforts through industrialization and technological progress has made us financially richer, it has pushed the earth to the brink of destruction, according to environmentalist Ellery Acres, who spent 20 years living in a tent in the wilderness. Well, in her new book of poems, Swerve, Environmentalism, Feminism, and Resistance, Ellery addresses our unspoken grief about what's happening to the earth, talks about how we can make a difference by taking action, and explains that we need to recover the feminine sense of interdependence to heal the planet. And most importantly, she believes it's not too late. Ellery Acres is the author of two previous award-winning poetry books, Practicing the Truth and Knocking on the Earth, as well as a children's novel, Sarah's Waterfall. She's written 13 writing awards, and her poetry has been featured on NPR and in many publications, including American Life and Poetry, Poetry, and the American Poetry Review and the New York Times Magazine. She's also an artist and a naturalist, and she comes to us from her home in beautiful Marin County, California. Ellery, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
Oh, you're welcome. You have a fascinating journey, I think, and most of your life has been, I think, dedicated to the subtitle of your book, Environmentalism, Feminism, and Resistance.
Yes. I actually camp in the wilderness for 20 years. I want to be clear, I wasn't like John Muir. You know, he spent the whole year out there, but I wasn't tough like that. He would jump up and down in the snow, and I went home in the winter and had a job and a normal life. But I did really love being in the wilderness. I felt like it was great for my writing. I wrote all my books out there. I'm an artist, and I did a lot of landscape drawings out there. And I feel like it made me incredibly happy, and I do feel like nature is the original meditation teacher. It made me very peaceful.
Yeah. Where did you get your love for nature at how early an age?
I think probably when I was a child and I went out and I felt so connected to the birds. I've been a bird watcher forever.
Did you grow up in California?
No, I grew up in New York City, but luckily we spent the summers in different places that were like Long Island and were more in nature.
This new book, I saw that you dedicated it to Rachel Carson.
Yeah.
And for those who are not familiar with her, can you share a little bit about who she was?
She is one of my heroes, and she was an amazing environmentalist who changed the world, literally one person, which gives me hope we can all make big changes. So she is responsible for writing some great books, the most famous of which is Silent Spring, which really, because of that book, we have the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Wilderness Act, the EPA, even the very concept of ecology is because of her.
This book is compiled of poems that you wrote. Do you have that book with you right now?
Yes,
okay.
Of course.
Since I asked about Rachel Carson, you actually have a poem towards the end of the book about Rachel Carson. Could you read that for my listeners?
I'd love to read it. Rachel Carson, one thing your listeners might not know is that she had a cottage in Maine that she was always longing to go to. She was very sick at the end of her life, and she was longing to go there. So it's called Rachel Carson. I think of the way she bent over tide pools at night. A woman stooped in the dark with her flashlight, as if she were stepping into the lit harness of her work. I think of the way she lay under the stars because they were medicine, tumors near the collarbone, pain in her spine, radiation, crebiosin, arthritis, iritis. sightless for weeks, listening as her friend read a draft out loud, remembering the robin that fell dead from a branch. I think of the pages of notes about pesticides. I moan inside, and I wake in the night and cry out silently for Maine. And then more notes about pesticides. I think of the way the moon glazed the water when she crossed out words and wrote other words. I think of the way she knew that eels slid from brook to brook and then to the sea. I'm in luck because brown is cheapest, she said, when she bought a wig to cover her bald head at the Senate. I could never again listen happily to a thrush song, she said, if I had not done all I could. They called her spinster, alarmist, communist. I think of the eagles who came back because of her. I think of her open gaze, her resolve, her refusal to turn away from the wreck.
It's beautiful. She was a force, wasn't she?
She really was. And one thing that's clear to me is that this is a dark time for the earth. I mean, we can't say it isn't, but
yes.
We have come through dark times before. And, you know, when I was in college, I was just a dorky student, and I was worrying about my exams. But she was really doing her great work on DDT then.
Mm-hmm.
And if I had been awake at that point, which I wasn't, I would have thought, Rachel Carson is wonderful. She's terrific. Her ideas are great. But she's never going to win. The whole thing is hopeless. The polluters are too strong. You know, there's no chance. And I would have been so wrong. So this is one thing I think we have to remember now about climate change. We don't know what's going to happen. It doesn't look good. But I think it's really important to be relentlessly optimistic and that everyone can make a huge difference with their life right now.
You're also really, and Rachel Carson, but you yourself in your life, and certainly in this book of poetry, speaking about reverence for all life, aren't you?
Yes, I really feel, I mean, this is funny because I once went on a hike and my friend said to me, you know, gosh, are you just going for a hike all by yourself? And I wanted to say, you know, when I'm in nature, I don't feel alone at all. I feel connected to everything. And I think not only do I love nature, I feel like nature loves me back. And I feel a tremendous connection to animals and to plants.
How much of it, I'm thinking now about a quote from Louis Schwartzberg, who'd been on this show also. He's a Hollywood cinematographer, but has really become known lately, over the last 10 years, I suppose now, of his time-lapsed photography of nature. And he's really promoting that. And he had a quote in a TED Talk, and I might be paraphrasing, but he said he discovered that as we fall in love with the beauty, it's only when we fall in love with something that we can't help but want to protect it. And then I thought about my own life. When I was a young boy living in Springfield, Illinois, in the neighborhood we lived in, we had about 20 acres of woods behind my house. I spent all my time back in the woods.
Yeah.
I mean, I built tree forts. I went hiking.
Yeah.
I couldn't get enough of that. And so I grew up as an environmentalist because I fell in love with the trees and with the water and with the wind. And it strikes me that was at the heart of Rachel Carson's work. And that's what I picked up in your writing, in your book Swerve, and in the little bit of research I've done about you, too, that it's out of a sense of reverence and awe that, oh, my gosh, we have to protect this.
Yes, I think that's such a great point, Richard. I do think we do protect what we love, and nature is incredibly beautiful. It's also really funny, and it's enlivening. I remember once I was sitting by a stream, and I was writing because I write outdoors, and there was this dusky-footed wood rat came down, and it gave me this look like, this used to be a good neighborhood, you know. And it was so exasperated, it made me laugh. So I always feel this tremendous connection to animals.
The book Swerve, you chose to write about environmentalism, feminism, and resistance. What What is a common thread woven between all three?
I think that environmentalists are very clear that we are all interdependent. And, of course, this virus is very clear we are all interdependent. Environmentalists know that we're in the web of life together. And women have a really strong sense, I think, of community. And, you know, women are always looking out after each other. And I think feminism and is speaking up for that we're all related. And I know there's a really great forest ecology. I talk about this woman, Susan Simard, in my book. And
yes.
She has found that trees actually nurture the whole community, that the forest is the most important thing to these trees. And if a tree is sick, they send it sugar. So I feel like environmentalists and women and people who are activists are all speaking for our tremendous interdependence.
Oh, yeah. And they need to be speaking out more and more, actually. There are health benefits from trees. Can you share a little bit about what those are? Because right now, since so many people, whether it be Indiana, certainly California, New York, I found that for myself, trying to get out in nature more, the fresh
yeah.
air. And
yeah.
And if I walk with a friend, you know, I'm trying not to walk too closely, but
yeah.
but rather than just sitting at home, it is so beneficial, I think, especially because if anyone is empathic, and I know I am, you pick up the worry, you pick up the panic. You do that when you walk into a grocery store and you can't find
yeah.
any toilet paper.
Yeah, I think that's such a great point. I think nature is going to be a great healer right now. I always think of what John Muir said. He said, Earth has no sorrow that Earth cannot heal.
Mm.
And I feel like going outside is a wonderful thing to do right now. I mean, scientifically, studies have shown that nature can help with depression, anxiety, insomnia. There's a whole school of medicine in Japan called forest bathing. They take people out
yes.
in the woods, and their immune system goes up. They found it helps with diabetes. They found it helps kids with ADHD. It helps kids get better grades. It's really been studied as a great healer. I think it is a form of ancient medicine, and I feel like it's something that you don't have to keep a social distance from a tree, you know, so you can really benefit, I think, from being outdoors right now.
Yeah, and if people are longing for a hug, they can hug a tree, by golly.
Yeah.
And that tree will love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that you did live in a tent for 20 years. Talk again what inspired you to do this. What was the experience like? And mostly, what was the takeaway for you from doing that?
Well, one thing I really feel, speaking to the last point, it made me so happy, honestly. I just love being out there. I felt a sense of tremendous belonging
mm-hmm.
To all the animals and the plants. And I feel like one thing, I felt like nature was my teacher. And what it taught me was to slow down, to be present, to pay attention. And I think it is the original meditation teacher. It really taught me. Even certain animals taught me particular lessons. Like I remember once I saw a western wood peewee, which is a small brown bird, this little peewee, and it was right near its nest, and this stellar jay was in its territory. And this small brown bird just hurtled itself over and over at this stellar jay. This is the boundary. This is where my nest is. This is my territory. So certain animals taught me many things. And also, I feel like being around animals is so restful. Animals know how to rest. They don't expend energy if they don't have to.
Yes.
They know how to play, and they don't drive themselves like people do.
You also learned a lot about simplicity, didn't you, about simplifying your life?
You know, I grew up with Thoreau, and I really love Thoreau, who said, simplify your life. And I found that, weirdly, being in a tent and just having a sleeping bag and a notebook and a little camp stove was so wonderful. It just pared down my life to the essentials, and I love that.
Do you think that could be a positive byproduct of what people are going through? I mean, I am not making light at all of those who have been seriously ill or let alone have passed away because of this virus, but it has caused people to stop. From
yes.
the crazy, busy lifestyles.
Yes. And, you know, I think you probably know about this study. There was a Princeton study that shows if you don't become happier if you make more money over $75,000 a year. And it always makes me think that these oil barons and these polluters really think that making $1 trillion and is going to be more than making $1 billion are going to be happier.
Yeah.
And it's simply not true. More and more money on that level doesn't bring happiness.
What are you doing, by the way, now that you are landlocked in your home, I suppose? Well, you can go out and get out a walk. Are you involved with some online communities to reach out?
I really think this is a fantastic time to be an environmentalist because we can do things from home. I'm writing postcards. I belong to the Sierra Club. I belong to 350.org, uh-huh. which has this great project called StopTheMoneyPipeline.org. I'm trying to support this wonderful group called Reclaim Our Vote. I feel like this is a really important time in 2020 to get out the vote. And I'm trying to, like, inspire people to vote for senators and representatives that are conservationists.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea because that's been put on hold, it seems like, when we were starting to talk about politics a lot. Now it's just all about the coronavirus.
Yeah.
So I've even lost touch with what's happening with that as we head into convention times, which I'm assuming will be online probably for the first time in history.
Yeah.
So it's teaching us, it strikes me that this virus is teaching us to start thinking and living in a whole different way. And by golly, we've needed to do that, haven't we? Especially for the sake of the planet.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say it's a catastrophic thing for so many people, but I do see there is a silver lining in that it's possible that we could use this restructuring that we're going to have to do to have a better carbon footprint, and then people could, you know, do more remote working. So there might be a silver lining in this. Also, I think it's showing us that two things that are very parallel to climate change. One is delay is a problem, and two is we can make sudden swerves and sudden changes that are helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd like for you to read another poem in your book, if you would. It's page 20, What Nature Teaches Us. There's also another one, perhaps we could have you read too, about, I believe it's the ocean?
Yes.
Yeah, the water. I love water. I guess being a Pisces that has something to do with it too. But I find both water and nature just so relaxing. And if I need to make even decisions about something, I just find that when I go out to nature, or if I'm fortunate enough to be by a large lake or a river, I go to a river here, you have the ocean close to where you are, it just clears things away. And I remember something Richard Rohr, who's a great Franciscan teacher, he's written a lot of books, but he said that Franciscan theology says that nature was the first Bible. And I loved that thought, you know, because that's where the divine can speak, I think, the loudest and sometimes the clearest to all of us.
I so agree with you.
Yeah. So one of the poems was called What Nature Teaches
Us. Nature Teaches
Us. Yes, uh-huh.
That it slows you down so you can hear the stream as it pours. It reminds you, you're in the body it made for you. The quiet in the deep ground reminds you, the rock gouged by wind. You can stand under a tree as it rests in its own frank love of itself. Rarely you see this in a man or woman, often in a tree. In the glare and heat, you can hear a garter snake slide across gravel. Your body likes to sit and watch the day moon. And you're surrounded by chlorophyll as it binds the sun in the leaves. And you sit under those leaves in the calm air, and your mind surrenders its locomotives, and you breathe.
How does your poetry evolve? Does it start with a title, or you just start with a feeling and the words just start coming out and you put it on paper? What is your process?
I, as I mention often, or almost always work outdoors. And so I'm outside in nature, and I do a process I call becoming, which is something shamans used to do, and I think probably poets and artists are the only people who still do it. But I'm also a visual artist, and I will sit in front of a tree, and I won't even make a mark, either visually on my sketchbook or on my notebook, until I feel like I have become the tree from the inside out. I often just sit there and say, what's it like to be you? I want to know how it feels with that xylem and phloem. So I try to really become what I'm writing about before I write it.
And then you feel it.
And then I feel it, and then the words come after that. But I often will sit there for like 3 hours and just try to, with some humility, just take away my human, you know, worries and all that stuff, and just try to really feel what it's like to be what I'm writing about.
Yeah, about getting out of the head and into the heart.
Exactly.
And I can tell myself when I'm in the head, which still sometimes is too often, but also when something comes from the heart, and it's a profound difference.
Absolutely.
And we need more of the heart these days, don't we?
I think so. I mean, one reason I wrote this as a book of poems, you know, poetry isn't exactly popular. I once called information in New York, and I said, could you give me the name of the Poetry Society of America? And she came back, and she said, I've looked everywhere under Poultry Society, American Society of Chicken Ranchers. I can't find anything. So it's not exactly, you know, your most popular media, but I feel like poetry speaks to the heart and the soul. It just cuts to the core. And it is, I mean, Carl Jung said this, the psychologist, he says poetry carries the soul of the culture, and I think that's true.
Yeah, yeah. I would agree with that as well. Talk about your poem, Reasons to Love the Sea, and how did you write that? How did the words come to you?
Okay, let me just look up that poem.
Yeah. Page
11. I've got a lot of poems about the sea. I love the sea. Well, again, I'm sure I wrote this outside, and I live near the sea. And so I think it came to me through my senses, smelling the sea, being listening to the sea, being very present with the sea. And I really like the idea of, I mean, I'm a poet who writes a lot of stuff, and I just free write a lot. It's called free writing, and I just throw everything down, and I don't worry about it, and sometimes I can get a chant going. So this was a chant poem.
Okay.
Shall I read it?
Yes, please.
Reasons to Love the Sea. Because it has no core. Because sometimes it's all dark cramp and sargasso. Because it's stingray and swordfish and blades. Because sea lions sigh in the dark and water sprinkles at the end of their whiskers. Because a cormorant dives and brings up a herring in his bill and shakes it and shakes it. Because it reflects the pale bellies of boats. Because shearwaters cross back and forth across it 40,000 miles a year. Because lobsters march in formation at the bottom. Because the dead rain to the bottom. Because when a gull ships on the sea, it looks like a stream of chalk. Because it's heartless and cold and alive and it stinks. Because at noon, it looks like light on a platter. Because it's a great discarder and spits out crates and slats and gallon jugs and tar. Because we sail across it in our stiff ships and try to forget that wherever we are, everything underneath is loosening and sliding. Because of spray, scud, clumps of foam that skid along the beach, by the wind sailors that glint like cellophane. Because rivers unravel and lose their cold in its volume. Gulls blink like sparks in the sweep of a lighthouse beam. Because of its lacquer on a calm night, distinct. Because when I'm swimming, I can see the small starved lights on the shore.
When I hear your words from the last couple of poems that you read, again, I'm going back to, I think, for our civilization to survive and thrive, the need for greater simplicity, the need for greater quiet. I think it was the great Thomas Merton that once said, our busyness, I would add crazy busyness, mm-hmm. by living that way, we are doing great violence to ourselves.
That's true.
Yeah, and there's something about just stopping.
Yeah.
How are you navigating living in this world, doing good work that you're doing, without getting caught up in it?
Well, I think that the difficulty for me often is getting depressed and discouraged because I'm human, and being an environmentalist, working on climate change, of course I'm going to have moments when I think, oh my God, you know, we're toast, we only have 10 years. But I've really come to think that when I do that, I have to stop and think, it's true we have 10 years, but that is enough time. We can really make a difference. It's an amazing time to be alive, to be an activist, mm-hmm. and I better get busy. Mm-hmm. So I think that's my main difficulty, is navigating discouragement sometimes.
Hmm. What do you think the best way is to wake people up to not only the severity of what's happening to the environment, but even more so to the beauty of the environment? Because again, that quote, it's been true in my life. When I fall in love with something, with my children, friends, what have you, I'll do anything I can to protect them. So there's a wake-up time that we need to be having.
Yes, I agree with you. I think, you know, even just getting outside, spending time outside, drawing something outside. There's a practice you can do, or draw something every day, something that you see, a plant and how it changes. I think working on a local conservation issue, loving something in your neighborhood, I think the more people spend time outdoors, the better it'll be for environmentalism and for the earth.
I was thinking how important your book is to be published this year because of election year, and you touched on something earlier. I'd like to revisit that, and that is, I would imagine as an author, you're hoping this book will inspire people to elect the right senators and representatives who have a great conservation record, who will help protect the earth and not destroy it.
Yes, that was my hope, that I'd inspire people. The League of Conservation Voters has a site, and they list all the people who vote for the earth and people who are against the earth, and I really would love to inspire people to write their senators and representatives, because one thing politicians always tell us, you know, we never hear from people about conservation or climate change, and so we can change that, especially in this time when we have a little time at home. We can bombard these guys with, you know, postcards and emails and phone calls, and I am really inspired by the Sunrise Movement and by Greta Thunberg, and these people are leading the way. And we can make a huge difference. I feel like my mantra is action, and I get depressed, and I think, oh, my God. And then I think, Ellery, stop. Take some action. Write a postcard. Do something simple. You know, really take a stand.
I have been inspired by Greta as well and other young people. What is it, do you think, about young people that they just have that boldness that I think others who have aged a bit don't?
Yes. I think they're fantastic, and they have made a huge difference in the momentum on climate change, just a huge difference. I think they, you know, don't maybe see, they're not world-weary like the rest of us old folks are, and they also, this is their lives at stake, their future, their jobs, their health. They see that looming with them. I think one of the things that they are also pointing out is that we can make a difference. Like, I've just read this wonderful statistic. We're at a tipping point. I guess it takes 3.5% of the population to make a change in history. That's not that many people. And we are close to getting that number of people in the United States to stand up for climate change issues. And there's also a great movement of reforestation, and Ethiopia just planted 350 million trees in one day. So there are many good things that are happening, and the incentive from these young people is spearheading a lot of great things.
Yeah, and that needs to happen. So I guess it's just keep on keeping on, right, with our books, with our podcasts, with our voices. I'd like to think that people will rise up and also go vote as well this November.
Yes. Yeah. And one of the things I really try to stress in my book is that we're not powerless. You know, we have a lot of power. And I always think what the Dalai Lama says. He says, if you think you're too small to make a difference, try sleeping with a mosquito.
True. And that does make a difference.
Yeah.
Why do you call your book Swerve?
Well, this is... I think, actually, it's so appropriate right now. We are in the middle, with this virus, of a very sudden swerve. I mean, suddenly everything has changed, and it's a catastrophic swerve. But there have been very many positive swerves in history that we were not expecting when things suddenly change for the better. I think of the Berlin Wall. You know, one day there's the wall, and the next day there's champagne. Or apartheid in South Africa. Who would have ever guessed that suddenly there'd be freedom for South Africa just almost overnight? And, you know, with DDT, with Rachel Carson. And in my book, I have a poem called At Any Moment There Could Be a Swerve in a Sudden Direction. And I mentioned this polluted Ohio River was so toxic it caught fire. And yet suddenly, within a few years, it got cleaned up. So my feeling that I came to at the end of my book is we have turned things around before, and we can turn things around again.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we have to have that belief, don't we? We have to encourage one another as well. And again, that's the beauty of getting involved in online communities, especially online communities, given how so many people are in a sort of a lockdown wherever they're living.
Yes.
Reaching out and getting the information.
Yeah, I think it's a great time to stand up for the earth and help other people. I think this is happening. It's bringing up a lot of community with a lot of people.
I've always felt that there's a power in the divine feminine that we need now more than ever. We've had enough of the masculine.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally get that every man and every woman can have both.
Mm-hmm.
But in its second section of poetry, it was devoted to feminism.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like for you to speak to that, and especially in how that inhabits you and your belief systems and the choices you make and your thoughts on that, especially since the Me Too movement came out.
Yeah, I have a whole poem in the book about the Me Too movement, and to me it's very inspiring. Again, a swerve. Suddenly women stand up and things change. I mean, it is very inspiring. I also have a number of inspiring women in the book I read about. Barbara McClintock was a geneticist, and she found the secret of corn because she was a woman, and all the male biologists were imagining that the corn genes were fighting each other and competing with each other. And she said, no, they're cooperating. Nature is based a lot on cooperation. And so she had a whole different view of things. And I also mentioned Wangari Maathai, who's an environmental activist, who planted 51 million trees with her group. And sometimes women have just a whole different take on... I even have a poem about war. I mean, I think women really feel for life and for health. And I think that's clear in my book.
Yeah. The short poem for Wangari you wrote, she never forgets the stream she drank from as a child. Her husband calls her too strong-minded for a woman. In divorce court, she scolds the judge. He sends her to jail. When she gets out of jail, she and her group plant 51 million trees. You can't do it alone, she says.
Yeah, she was so great.
I think that is so awesome to see people like that rise up to have more of a divine feminine presence in our social action. There's another poem in that section I'd like for you to read. It's called Dandelion Woman.
Oh, yeah.
On page 36.
This is a sort of archetype of a healthy feminine who can rise up. It's called Dandelion Woman.
Yes.
Dandelion Woman says the earth will not be scorched beyond repair. Her name means Tooth of the Lion. She knows how to make aspirin out of willow bark. The rain likes her. The grass likes her. She says no to hotels with gold doorknobs. No to Vogue. She's not defined by the stares of men. She's defined by the gaze of stars. She knows what's outside her is inside her. The calcium in her bones from shells. The iron in her blood from crusts on rocks that leached into the sea. She knows nothing is divided. The wind parts the grass the same way she parts her hair. She has enough when she smells the forest. She loves minerals. She loves stones. She leans on basalt and chert as if they were sofas. She knows how to shake this old furnace of a world until it coughs up what's choking its core.
Hmm. Which is why I think we need more women in political office, don't you?
I do too.
I remember talking many years ago to Betty Williams on this show. She had won the Nobel Peace Prize, her and Mairead Corrigan, for their work they did with peace people in Northern Ireland back when all the violence was still continuing between Protestants and Catholics. And she said that wasn't in their 10-year plan. They were moms, and a group of kids got killed by accident because soldiers were fighting one another, and they got so angry without even calling a meeting. They just knocked on each other's door, and they started knocking on door after door after door and encouraging people to say, this is enough. Our children are dying. This is enough. And it quickly grew into this huge movement that caught the world's attention, and they ended up winning the Nobel Peace Prize that year. I think that was 1976, maybe. But her thought in that interview was, that's when she felt like mothers are more sensitive to those kind of things, what happens to our children. The divine feminine, without going into the whole theology of that, is more wired for that. And that's why she felt we needed more women in office to speak to that point. We've had enough men. We've had enough wars. We've had enough of the divine masculine.
Yeah.
And she was advocating for that, gosh, decades ago.
Oh, boy, they were wonderful. I mean, I do think women really speak for the life force.
Yeah. Yeah. So your last section of poetry is, you chose the word resistance. Why that word?
Well, I mean, the last section certainly is political in the sense that we need to take action and resist what's going on at the moment. Mm-hmm. And so there's a number of poems about it's not too late. And one poem is called We Have the Power to Pull Back from the Brink. And one of the epigraphs in that poem I think is wonderful, from Alice Walker, speaking of the feminine. The most common way people give up their power is by thinking they don't have any.
Yes, yes.
And so I do think there is tremendous reason to hope, and we can use this 10 years and really turn things around.
Two things. First of all, what do you think is the most effective form of resistance right now?
Well, I think this year, 2020, is getting out the vote. We really need to get in people in power in America that are really going to help the earth. I think that's one of the most effective things. And anything one can do with, you know, Reclaim Our Vote or other groups like Swing Left or any groups that are really trying clean water action, the Sierra Club, Indivisible, groups that are working to get people to vote, especially for environmental issues.
Yeah, yeah. You've mentioned several times in our conversation about only 10 years to beat climate change. Can you share more about that? Why 10 years?
Well, I mean, that is what, you know, the scientists are telling us. That's that's the time frame that we have left. But I really believe with Christiana Figueres, she's my hero along with Rachel Carson. She is one of the women who really put through the Paris Agreement, and she feels that we have time to really change the future. And she sees two futures. One is dark, and we all know that one. But the other one is we are reforesting the earth. Cities are transformed. People are doing things like we're doing now, working remotely. She sees a possibility of hope. And I think we can, you know, 10 years is enough time for everyone on the planet to make such a difference. I mean, I think we have to be kind to ourselves, too, because we're the only group of people that's ever had to deal with overwhelming issue like this.
Yes.
And so it's overwhelming for a lot of people, but we actually can make a difference with our lives right now, which no one has ever had a chance to do before in history.
Yeah, and we can do that by giving voice to the issues and also by following up with action, and action born out of love, not hate.
Yes, I think if we work from fear or hate, it's not going to be effective. But if we work from love, and if we try, which is always very difficult, to keep a kind of meditative attitude to it. I feel like when I meditate, I don't go, well, today I'm going to get enlightened and that's going to be the end of it. You know, I just do small, steady meditations on a daily basis. And I think that's one of the keys to taking action right now. What can I do today and do it in a steady way and do it with other people, maybe online, and feel I'm part of a group? Because optimism is contagious and it helps to be with other people.
Absolutely. In closing, I'd like for you to read one more poem, and I think it's timely that we read the one titled Why There Is Reason to Hope. It's on page 46 in your book.
Oh, thanks. And this was dedicated to a woman who really spearheaded saving Point Reyes National Seashore. It was about to be built. It was going to be condominiums. There were maps. It was all slated for development. And she said, this ain't right. And she really spearheaded the change. So it's called Why There Is Reason to Hope. Because many people love the delicate ferns. Because many people love streams. It's not all brackish. It's not all Clorox. Trees grow out of the slash of the burn. Clouds inside us travel up and down our spines. I've seen teenagers willing to be handcuffed outside of Congress. I've seen a girl in a raincoat protesting in front of the Swedish Parliament. I've seen grown men crawl over gravel so as not to disturb cormorants at their nests. And when I walk this trail, I remember the condominiums that were going to be built here. I remember the blueprints with their windows and doors. I remember the people who loved salmonberry, huckleberry. They are the ones who said stop, who said no.
Yes. Ellery, what web domain do you have for people to contact you at?
I have www.elleryacres.com, and I also have www.elleryacresartist.com. Oh, no, it's www.info@elleryacresartist.com. So I have two websites, one for art and one for writing.
Wonderful. Well, this book is called Swerve, Environmentalism, Feminism, and Resistance. It's been a delight to have you on our program. This book is very timely. I'm with you, girl. We need to be shining that light and raising that consciousness, and I do believe things can turn around. And we will just attract more people to the tribe then.
Okay. Thank you, Richard.
Yeah. I so appreciate the work that Ellery does in the world. And, you know, we all know that we live in a world full of challenges, especially now. Yet, one of the biggest challenges is that not enough of us realize that we also live in a world full of solutions, and then live our lives as these solutions in action. I want you to know something. You are more powerful than you can possibly imagine. Your every single thought, word, and action makes a difference. And living your commitments and visions for the world in service to our global family not only makes a difference, but also creates more joy and fulfillment in your life. I mean, think about this. Just one person can make a difference. But you're not alone. We are part of a global family, and life is precious. Thinking, Ellery and I talking about reverence, the word reverence, I'm remembering now the closing statement of the Great Earth Charter, and it says, "Let ours be time remembered for the awakening of a new reverence for life, the firm resolve to achieve sustainability the quickening, the justice and peace, and a joyful celebration of life. And when I think about reverence, and when I think about falling in love with something so you can't help but want to protect it, I think about the story of a rabbi, and I want to share that with you now. You see, a rabbi was giving instruction to some children when he posed this question: how do you know the night is over and the day has come? Well, puzzled, the children took some time to answer. And then one of them ventured, "Well, you know the night is over and the day has come when at dawn you look out at a tree and you can tell whether it's an apple or a pear tree." The rabbi acknowledged this response, but repeated the question. A second student offered, "Well, you know the night is over and the day has come when you see an animal in the distance and you can tell whether it's a donkey or a horse." The rabbi acknowledged this response too. Then he repeated the question. Well, at this, the students, too puzzled to know how to answer, finally asked the rabbi to solve the dilemma he had posed. And the rabbi got quiet. He looked all into all of their eyes, for the eyes are the window to the soul. And he said, "You know the night is over, and the day has come when you look into the eyes of any human being, and you see there your brother or your sister. For if you do not see your brother or your sister, it's still night, and the day hasn't come." You know, the great French philosopher Teilhard de Chardin wrote, "Someday, after we have mastered the wind and the tides and the waves and gravity, we will harness for God the energies of love. And then, for the second time in human history, we will have discovered fire." Spirituality is an inner fire. It's a mystical sustenance that feeds our soul. And by the way, that quote is where I got the name for this radio show, Journey's Fire. And the purpose of the spiritual experience is to develop the eyes by which we see this inner fire and to live its mystery. Carl Jung once said, "No problem is resolved on the level at which it occurred. We must rise to a higher level to find a solution." I believe our culture has lost its sense of sacred connection to any power or authority higher than ourselves. We've lost our spiritual rudder, and without it, we have neither individual nor collective wisdom. You see, the surrender of human consciousness to its own divine element is our greatest tool for change. It is more powerful than bullets and more effective than any army. Sacred power is the greatest power in the universe. We were born to extend the power of our spiritual source and have deviated from that mission. The American dream, it's not a material thing. We often think it is, but it's not. The American dream is a fact that we have the right to dream at all. I love what Goethe said. He said, "Dream no small dreams, for they have no power to move the hearts of men and women." And as I look at our country and our world right now, especially in light of the coronavirus pandemic, people's hearts want to be moved. They want to believe in something powerful, larger than themselves, knowing we can turn this thing around. So, think about this. With the conviction of the heart in ending slavery, we committed to the dream. In giving women the right to vote, we committed to the dream. In passing child labor laws, we committed to the dream. In passing civil rights legislation, we committed to the dream. Every generation of Americans plays out the struggle between the forces that would expand the dream and those that would constrict it. And know this, dreams do not extend through armies or diplomacy or politics. They fly on the wings of passion. So, we must stand up. Millions of us, in full intellectual and emotional glory, each in our own way, and so express our own uniqueness in the service of greater good that the forces that would constrict us are transformed by love. You see, the power to be noble, must be the power of consciousness and compassion. We must become as vigilant, focused, and effective at the expression of love's power as others are in the expression of their hate. We must live for the day, and we must work for the day when humanity realigns itself with the radical love of God. You see, darkness has always sought to suck the spiritual lifeblood out of human civilization, while the love of God continues to pour forth upon us. The problem is not that we don't hear our hearts. The problem is that we do not heed the heart. We need to hear the call now. So I have a modest proposal. Let's ignite the world by leading with love. Become people who shower everyday life with unconditional love and grace to plead the case for compassion. You see, you and I are activists of the heart, and I've had them on this show every week through the years. Maya Angelou, Julia Butterfly Hill, Betty Williams, Oriah Mountain Dreamer, John Robbins, Don Miguel Ruiz, Jacob Needleman, Neil Donald Walsh, so many saying yes to the transforming power of love. And we are joining, again, where we can, each in our own way, what is perhaps the most sweeping movement of our times, birthing a new world in which our culture's toughest issues will be transformed with more humane, compassionate strategies and programs. We are ushering in a new society in which our most challenging social, economic, and environmental problems will be solved through nonviolent, non-exploitive, cooperative choices that better serve us all. So it's time to be outspoken. It's time to be lovingly and purposely strident. It's time to say that the status quo be overturned by the compassionate power of love. Senator Robert Kennedy expressed this eloquently in the 1960s. He said, "It is not enough to allow dissent. We must demand it, for there is much to dissent from. We dissent from the fact that millions are trapped in poverty while the nation grows rich. We dissent from the conditions and hatred which deny a full life to our fellow citizens because of the color of their skin. We dissent from the monstrous absurdity of a world where nations stand poised to destroy one another and men must kill their fellow men. And we dissent from the willful, needless destruction of the natural sources and beauty." So, what are you ready to dissent from? I mean, what do you care so deeply about that you have to take a stand? For what are you willing to call on and activate all your spiritual force and assistance? Three frogs were sitting on a lily pad. One frog decided to jump. How many frogs were left? Three. Deciding is a thought. Jumping is an action. What action are you going to take? Because, getting back to the rabbi, you know the night is over and the day has come when you can look into the eyes of any human being and there see your brother or your sister. That's today's program. I want to thank Ellery Akers for being my special guest. I want to thank you for always joining me each week. And I want to thank my engineer, Aaron Duvall, and production coordinator, Angel Richardson. I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Journey's Fire. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.